Looking forward very much, as we do every year at this time, to the beginning of the Vacation Bible School tomorrow night. The building will be filled with people, lots of children, very excited and very enthusiastic to learn about holiness. The theme for the Vacation Bible School fits in with the theme that we've selected with which to challenge ourselves here at Eastside during this year. Holiness, be holy, for I am holy. And so the children are going to be talking about Bible characters, and they'll go from class to class each night and study the life of a different character whose life manifests holiness. And for those who are adults in the auditorium, Brother Dave Brewer from Pittsburgh will be with us, traveling to Bowling Green as we speak. And we'll be here, and he'll be talking from night to night about each of those same Bible characters and challenging us to holiness as well. We've had a lot to say about holiness going all the way back to the beginning of the year. We've defined holiness and talked about what it is, and maybe even just as significantly, at least, what it is not. Holiness is not, as it is commonly understood in the world, piety. Although a holy person would be a pious person, that would be a manifestation or a characteristic of holiness. Holiness has to do, as we were reminded in the lesson this morning, with distinctness or separateness. God was holy, and that made God distinct and different from anything else that deemed to call itself or to be called by people a God. And because God was holy, as again we were reminded this morning, all of God's actions are holy. All of God's words are holy. And it's obvious in all three of the biblical ages or dispensations, the patriarchal age from creation up until Mount Sinai, and then the age that we sometimes refer to as the Levitical period, or the period during which the law of Moses governed the Israelites, and then certainly it's true now, holiness is an important part of being in a right relationship with God. And so the children are going to learn valuable and important lessons about holy conduct. And how is it that we are holy people? How is it that we honor the command from the book of Leviticus, where God charged the Israelites at Mount Sinai, "Be holy, for I am holy." And Peter repeats that, and others reference it and repeat it in the New Testament as well, but especially Peter, who admonishes us, those of us who are God's children, to be holy. How do we do that? How do we conduct ourselves in that way? And so, five characters were chosen. That was not an easy task, because there are so many holy men and women about whom we read in both the Old and the New Testament. And it had to be singled out. It had to be narrowed down to five. But in that discussion some months ago, and if you're not aware of or familiar with how this works, this process of getting ready for what's going to happen starting at 7 o'clock tomorrow night has been ongoing for a number of weeks, several months, as a matter of fact. And you'll know that that's so when you arrive tomorrow night and when you send your children to the classes, when you go back and take a look at the classrooms. I don't know if it would be appropriate for everybody to go back and look at them tonight or not. I think that some of them are still in the preparation stages, but sometime during the course of the week, take a few moments and go back and look at the classrooms and look at the preparations. Know and understand all of the hours that the teachers and those who are going to be working with your children have put in to trying to help them learn about holiness and what it means to be holy. But in that discussion of who to choose, which Bible characters do we pick, how many from the Old Testament, how many from the New Testament, how many men, how many women, how do we balance all of that out, there was a general agreement. It's my understanding, I wasn't involved in those discussions, but it's my understanding that there was a general agreement that something should be said about the priests in the Old Testament. But there wasn't any way to work that subject into the few nights that we have in the Vacation Bible School. And so I was asked if I would spend some time talking about the priests, God's holy priests. And holiness certainly is a word that God intended, at least, to apply to the priesthood in the law of Moses. And so what I'd like to do for just a few minutes tonight, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, But I want us to go back to Leviticus chapters 8, 9, and 10. The fact of the matter is we've had several lessons. I've had several lessons during the course of this year about this section of the book of Leviticus. We were reminded from the pulpit this morning that the book of Isaiah is a book that is filled with admonitions to holiness. Now, the book of Leviticus is another one of those Old Testament books that holiness is seeped into almost every instruction or teaching in the book of Leviticus. It's only come to my attention, I'm embarrassed about this, it's only come to my attention in recent years how important the book of Leviticus is. I think a lot of people have tended to look at the book of Leviticus as optional reading for the Christian. That the book of Leviticus, it gets its name from the fact that these are instructions for the Levites and the priests. And so we've tended to look at the book of Leviticus as more of an instruction manual than a book of the Old Testament. But the fact of the matter is, the book of Leviticus is an extremely important book to understanding something about the character of God. Gordon Wenham, in his commentary, I've shared this with you before, but for those of you who are visiting, Gordon Wenham, a denominational scholar, wrote a wonderful commentary on the book of Leviticus. And one of the very first things he says in the introduction is that as far as the Jews were concerned, when it came to the responsibility of raising their children, teaching their children about God, it started with Leviticus, that they began with Leviticus. When I read that, I was stunned. And you read the first sentence and it says something like that, you think, well, there's not going to be much of value in this commentary. But he went on to explain, and I've come to understand from further study that he was exactly right, that when the Israelites, and this is a generalization, but when the Israelites began the process of teaching their children, starting in infancy, about God, they started in the book of Leviticus. We start, generally speaking, in the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis is where the stories are. And we can do coloring pages, and we can do projects, and we can build arcs, and we can do all of the, you know, just so many things, hands-on kinds of things that we can do. So we start in the book of Genesis, but the Jew, according to Wenham, and many others, incidentally, the Jews didn't start there. They started in the book of Leviticus. And the reasoning, the thinking was this, that the most important lesson that we teach our children at the very beginning, the first principle, the foundational principle is God is holy. God is holy. And once that principle is instilled in the children, now we can go back to Genesis and we can start telling them those stories. And the stories will make a lot more sense to them. In the context of the holiness of God, questions like, why would God destroy every living thing on the face of the planet, with the exception of those things that might survive in the ark over a period of a little over a year? Why would God do that? That's challenging to an adult mind, let alone a child's mind, unless we understand and know something first about the holiness of God and what that holiness means. And so it's not surprising when God brings the Israelites out of Egypt, and most everyone in this audience, I think, is well acquainted with and would be very familiar with that story. When God brings the Israelites out of Egypt and He gets them across the Red Sea and He brings them to Mount Sinai, and then He sends Moses up to the top of Mount Sinai to receive the law. And a number of things happened during this period of time that we're not going to have time to talk about. But a part of the law, a big part of the law that was received at the base of Mount Sinai, was instructions that God gave for the priests and the work that the priests would do. So I want us to think about God's holy priests for just a few minutes in the lesson tonight. I want to make three points, and the lesson will be yours. From what we read in Leviticus chapters 8, 9, and 10, the first point is this, that the holiness of God was intended by God to be beneficial for His people. We don't have time tonight in this lesson to read every verse of Leviticus chapters 8, 9, and 10, but the beginning of chapter 8 in Leviticus is the beginning of a time of celebration for the Israelites. Up to this point, God, He's chosen them as a people, He's led them out of Egyptian slavery, He's brought them to the wilderness, and He's been, over a period of time, giving them kingdom laws, rules and ordinances and regulations that would govern them as citizens of the kingdom of God. But in chapter 8, they pause. There's a change. And God says to Moses, I want you to set aside Aaron and his sons, and we're going to ordain them or appoint them as priests. And so that's exactly what Moses does. He has Aaron and his sons washed. He has them changed into new clothes, the clothing that had been specifically appointed by God for the priests. They are anointed with oil, and they are anointed with blood from the sacrifices that had been made on the altar. All of that took place over a period of a week, over a period of 7 days. On the eighth day, as you read through Leviticus chapter 8 and on into chapter 9, the excitement, the anticipation heightens and intensifies. God is preparing to set Aaron and his sons officially and formally in place. And so he instructs them to set up a sacrifice, to put the offerings on the altar. And if they've done everything exactly the way that God intended for them to do, then what's going to happen is fire is going to come down from heaven and consume these sacrifices that are made on behalf of the priests. And sure enough, that's exactly what happens. Look at chapter 9, verses 22, 23, and 24, which is the culmination of this ceremony, of the priests being set apart and sacrifices being offered for them. The text says that Aaron lifted up his hands toward the people and blessed them. And he stepped down after making the sin offering and the burnt offering and the peace offerings. Moses and Aaron went into the tent of meeting. When they came out and blessed the people, Moses says, the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. Then fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offerings and the portions of fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. Imagine what an occasion that must have been. They've already seen, over the course of the last several months, they've already seen incredible things done by God. The plagues, including the Passover, the death of the firstborn, and the Passover, which delivered their firstborn from that particular plague. They've watched Pharaoh and his army drown in the Red Sea after they marched across the bed of the Red Sea as though it were dry ground or on dry ground, and watched all of them die. Water has been provided for them. Food has been provided. So many things, the text says, that God has done for them. But I think it's interesting here that in this particular text in verse 24, it says when they saw this, they shouted, all of the people shouted and fell on their faces. Why did they shout? Why did they shout? Well, one possibility is that they were startled by this fire coming down from heaven. That doesn't seem especially reasonable to me. Again, think about all the things they've seen up to this point in time. Wenham suggests in his commentary, and my guess is that he's probably pretty spot on in regard to this, this was a shout of joy. This was a shout of victory. It's done now. We are a people. We have a kingdom law. We have this covenant with God. But now we have priests to offer sacrifices for us. These priests have been set in place. And so I suspect, again, there are another possible interpretation or two, but I suspect that it's likely that this is a shout of joy. But it also says that they fell on their faces. That they fell on their faces. What is it that caused them to respond or to react that way? I would suggest to you, at the very least, what they are seeing when they see this fire come down from heaven is that they are seeing a manifestation of the power of God. And being in the presence of this manifestation of the power of God, they fall on their faces. That's the reaction very often, as a matter of fact, almost always in God's Word, when some human being comes in contact with the divine, with God. It's so overwhelming. It's so overpowering. In this particular case, the holiness of God These sacrifices have not only been offered, but these sacrifices have been accepted. And we know that the sacrifices have been accepted because look at what God has done for us. God has accepted these sacrifices. We now are a people and we have a priesthood. God intended for His holiness to be beneficial to believers. And He intended for the priest to be a visible and a physical manifestation of that holiness. They're not always going to see things like fire coming down to the altar. Most days, they're going to see a fire if they bring offerings to the altar. But it's going to be a fire that's going to have been lit by the priests themselves. And it's going to be kept going by the priests. And they're going to see the fire consume the offerings, but not fire coming down from heaven. Just the fire that has been offered and tended and has been kept up by the priests. From this point on, the priests are going to be the visible manifestation of all of those sacrifices. All of those sacrifices. All of those appeals to God for atonement, for forgiveness of sins. All of the sacrifices that are offered for any purpose from this point on are going to come through the priest. Ideally, the priesthood would have been a tremendous benefit to a nation like the nation of Israel. As far as we know, no other nation in antiquity is given something like this by God. But the Old Testament scriptures reveal to us that God made this arrangement with the Israelites. I will set holy priests in place. I will consecrate them. I will give them special garments. Garments so that when the people see them, they will know there's something different about them. Know there's something distinct about them. And those people will be the stand between, the go-between, between the people and the holiness of God. Something, though, on this eighth day goes horribly wrong. And we read about that beginning in chapter 10. And I think probably most everyone in this audience is well acquainted with this story or familiar with this story. One of the amazing things to me is what we're told in verses 1, 2, and 3 of Leviticus chapter 10. It is something that happens, and you read on in Leviticus chapter 10. By the time you get to the end of Leviticus chapter 10, I think it's obvious and clear that what happens in verses 1 through 3 takes place on the very same day that this holy convocation occurred. I mean, the people are gathered together. They're anticipating a manifestation of the holiness of God. They see this incredible miracle, the fire coming down from heaven and consuming the sacrifices on the altar. And they shout and they fall down on their faces. At some point while all of that is going on, we read this. Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans. And after putting fire in them, placed incense on it, and offered strange fire before the Lord, which He had not commanded them. The fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them. Remember what had just happened at the end of chapter 9. The fire came down from the Lord and consumed the sacrifices. And those sacrifices are gone. Now Moses says that fire comes down from the Lord, from the presence of the Lord, and consumes them. And they died before the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, it is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I will be treated as holy. And before all the people, I will be honored. And then the text says, and I've always admired Aaron for this, not everything that Aaron does, not everything that Aaron has done up to this point is worthy of admiration and respect. But in this regard, we admire Aaron because God basically says to Aaron, your sons have disrespected me. They have disrespected my holiness. And because of that, He will go on to say to Aaron, I don't want you to mourn these boys. I don't want you to put on clothes of mourning. I don't want you to remove these holy priestly garments and put on the clothes of mourning. And the text says that Aaron, therefore, kept silent. He does what God instructs him to do. But what about this story of Nadab and Abihu? It is compelling, I think, that what they are charged with, and incidentally, I don't know exactly what it means when it says that they offered strange fire. We've studied the book of Leviticus. We've had lessons on this. We've talked about that before. It may be some commentators think that what that means is that they carried incense into the most holy place, which only the high priest would have the right to do. Some think that they were drunk in administering these sacrifices. There is some support, maybe support to that in the possible translations of some of the words in this text. It could be that they used a different mixture for the incense than the mixture, the formula for the incense that God used. But all of that is beside the point. Whatever strange fire was, what God says is, I didn't tell them to do that. And when they did it, they disrespected my holiness. They offered strange fire before the Lord, which He had not commanded them. God says, I intend to be treated as holy, and I intend to be honored before all of the people. The holiness of God is such an awesome thing that in Leviticus chapter 9, the people shouted, probably shouted with joy, shouted a shout of victory when they saw a manifestation of the holiness, the power of God, and the provision of God in setting up for them the priesthood. But it is compelling that on that same day they saw the fire come from God for a different purpose. And that is that God punished Nadab and Abihu. He consumes them with the same fire that had consumed the sacrifice because they were disobedient to Him. They had not kept His commandment. It is very common in the 21st century. But what I want to say about that is that it's not new in the 21st century. The idea in people's minds that worship is for the worshiper. Worship is, and worship can be anything that we deem it to be. That whatever makes me feel a certain way, or whatever mood I happen to be in at the time. And we learn in stories like this that that's not so. As a matter of fact, it is the holiness of God that is impugned when we tamper with God's instructions about how He is to be worshipped, how He is to be served, how He is to be honored. God did not reserve that for us. God did not give us that right or that privilege. God says, I will be treated as holy. In other words, my people will do exactly what I tell them to do. And they'll do it in exactly the way that I tell them to do, or they'll suffer the consequences for that. That grace doesn't alter or change that, by the way. I know that in some people's minds it's popular to say or to think or to reason, well, under the old law, it was all about keeping rules. It was all about doing things exactly right. But under the new law, it's about grace. Grace plays an important and prominent role in the patriarchal age and dispensation. And there is no patriarch who would have been saved absent the grace and mercy of God. Grace is a very prominent part of the Mosaical period. Because we're told, for example, in the book of Hebrews, really, if you stop and think about it, what power does the blood of bulls and goats have to take away sins? I mean, what magic is there in the blood of bulls and goats to take away sin? Well, and yet God treated those people as though their sins had been removed or taken away when they offered the blood of bulls and goats. He treated them with grace. He showed them mercy. He forgave them of their sins. Grace is not something that is absent from two-thirds or more of human history and all of a sudden makes an appearance in the world in the first century when Jesus dies on the cross. If a patriarch was saved, he was saved by grace and not by works. If a Levite, if a member of the tribe of Judah, if any of the Israelites were saved, they were saved not by the works they did, but they couldn't be saved that way. Because if you're trying to be saved by keeping works of law and you stumble in one point, you're guilty of all. If they were saved, they were saved by the grace of God and by the mercy of God, and we are too. That's not the question. The question is, when we talk about God being holy, what does that mean? And when we talk about this provision that God makes, God is not to be trifled with. And God's word is not something to be trifled with. I don't know what motivated Nadab and Abihu to do what they did. I really don't understand, to be completely honest with you, what motivated Aaron to act the way that Aaron did. How does a father witness the death of two of his sons in this catastrophe, in this horrible way, and not mourn and not grieve and not react as though some horrible, terrible thing had happened in his life? But that's what God instructed him to do. God says, I will be treated as holy. If we understand something about holiness, as we were reminded in the lesson this morning, if we understand something about holiness, and especially of these priests. These are my priests. These people are the people that I've set up to act as a go-between, mediators. They're going to be the ones that are going to offer the sacrifices. I insist, God says, that they be holy as well. And part of what that means is they are obedient to God. Now, the third point in connection with that, we're talking about God's holy priest. We need to think something about, or we need to say something about the holiness of Jesus as our high priest. Because the fact of the matter is, the particulars have changed, the circumstances have changed, but the system remains basically the same. In the patriarchal age, sacrifices were offered. The priest was the head of each family, apparently, at least that's what little we know of the pattern in the patriarchal age, however many centuries that would have been, however many millennia that would have been, that it was the patriarch, it was the head of the household who acted as the priest. The priests from Mount Sinai until the cross, the priests were the Levites, and in particular the descendants of Aaron who were serving as priests. We still operate under a priesthood in the Christian dispensation, or the Christian age. And the author of the book of Hebrews especially makes that clear to us, that Christ is our high priest. Just one passage, Hebrews chapter 4, verses 14 through 16. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Jesus Christ is now our high priest. Not a high priest according to the order of Levi. He wasn't a descendant of Levi. He couldn't be a priest according to the law of Moses because he wasn't from the right tribe. But that law has been fulfilled, finished, completed, and set aside. And a new covenant, a new law has taken its place. And we have a new high priest. And that high priest is Christ. This point would take a whole series of lessons to develop and do it justice. The Levites had dozens of high priests. I don't remember Josephus. I think the number that Josephus says from Aaron until Annas and Caiaphas in the first century is something like 80 or 81 high priests who served during that period of time. In the 2,000 years since the cross, we still have the same high priest. There's just one. How many hundreds of thousands of sacrifices did those 80-something high priests offer over those centuries? Innumerable numbers of animals who were killed and offered as sacrifices. The author of the book of Hebrews and others in the New Testament suggest Jesus only had to offer himself one time for all time. The sacrifice was perfect because the one offering the sacrifice was perfect. And so there's not any reason for additional sacrifices to be offered. This passage would imply that sometimes the high priests, those 80 or 80, you know, one or however many there were from the beginning of the law of Moses until the time of Christ, however many high priests there were during that period of time, some of them were good men, some of them were good people, but not all of them were. But we don't have to worry about the character of our high priest, because he was tempted in all points like we are, yet without sin. Some of those men probably would not have been, perhaps at least, would not have been very sympathetic to the weaknesses and the sins and the shortcomings of the people that they were serving. That's not a problem with us. We have a high priest who can sympathize with us in every way, sympathize with our weaknesses, because he knows them. He was a human being himself. He was a man himself. He took on the form of man. He became a man. And so it puts him in a perfect position to serve as high priest. But what I would suggest to you is this, and then the lesson will be yours. The title of the lesson is God's Holy Priests. And I've thought about that a lot over the last few weeks, and especially in connection with how do we attach this to the Bible study, to the Vacation Bible School. What is the application that we make? I think the application, or at least the application that I want to make, is this. There is still not only a high priest, there is still a priesthood. And like the cartoon character said, we have seen the enemy and they are us. We are the priests. We are the priests. We are what the world sees of the holiness of God. When God's holiness is demonstrated and manifested, it's manifested and demonstrated in our speech, in our conduct, in our compassion, in our dress, our appearance. It's manifested in our character, in our demeanor, in how we treat other people, in how we respond to various situations. I have to tell you that, and just, you know, from a personal standpoint, there are so many times in my life when my actions, my words, my conduct were not at all characteristic of a priest, of a holy God. And it is devastating when you come to the realization that you are a priest. And we don't wear the physical garments that those priests wore, but we look a certain way, we act a certain way, we talk a certain way, we think a certain way. We represent the holiness of God to all the people we come in contact with. And there have been things that I have done, way too many things that I have done in my life, that are considerably more like the actions of Nadab and Abihu than they are the actions in this particular context of Aaron, who did exactly what God told him to do. That's an awesome thing to consider. Again, as we were reminded in the lesson this morning, it's not just to understand, that's where it starts, but it's not just to understand that God is holy. It is to understand that God expects us to illustrate that holiness to the people with whom we come in contact. And so it's the people that we are doing business with. It's the students with whom we are sharing instruction from some teacher in a classroom somewhere. It is the neighbors who live in the same neighborhood, the same subdivision, the same city where we live. It's the drivers who share the same highways that we're driving on. We have so many family members and friends in town this weekend. And just a glorious weekend for me to be surrounded by all of those people and to be a part of some of those proceedings. People started leaving at about 1 o'clock, 1:30 from our house this afternoon, and there were tears shed, mostly mine when the grandchildren were walking out the door. But some of the grandkids cried too, that they had to leave. And it's hard not to smile in the face of that. I'm saying all of that to say this. We started getting the texts about 30 minutes later. Just crossed the state line, sitting on Interstate 65, and we're stopped. And then we'd get another text, sitting in a parking lot on Interstate 65. Haven't moved for the last 30 minutes. And, well, a couple of things. One of them is I was more grateful than ever for my recliner. But I also got to thinking about how frustrating that is. Have you ever been in a traffic jam like that? Have you ever been in a traffic jam like that? Maybe when you were especially anxious to get someplace. Maybe you had an appointment to keep. And how frustrating it is. How do we react to the people around us? How do we respond to the people around us when we get in that kind of a tight, frustrating situation or circumstance? Do we act like priests who manifest the holiness of God, who demonstrate the holiness of the God we serve to all other people? There are many things that the Bible says about Christians being priests. I'm not going to take the time to expand on all of these, but we are, as priests, we are His chosen servants, authorized to draw near to Him. I mean, we can approach God in a way that the common Israelite couldn't approach God. Only the priest could. And even not even all of them could approach God as closely as only the high priest could. But we have access to the Father through our high priest because we are priests. And that makes it possible for us then to serve God's people, to serve other Christians and other people as well. As priests, we have, as we just mentioned, full access to God's throne. We are authorized and called to minister to God's people. And we are responsible for making our bodies a living sacrifice to God. That's a great passage in the book of Romans, that we present our bodies as a living sacrifice to God. From David's time on, the priests served in courses. A priest might live a long way from the city of Jerusalem, and it wouldn't be expedient for that priest to have to be there every day. And so David set it up so that when the temple was built, the priest would come, I think it was out of every 12 months, they would come and live in Jerusalem for 1 month, and they would serve during that month, and then they would go home. Their service then was, even then, was only partial. A priest served 1 month out of 12. We present our bodies as a living sacrifice. We are offering our bodies as a living sacrifice to God every minute of every hour of every day of the year. Every word that comes out of our mouths is a living sacrifice to God. Every gesture, every facial expression, every outfit, every interaction with another person or group of people is a sacrifice that we are offering to God. And remember what God said in the aftermath of Nadab and Abihu: I will be regarded as holy by those who serve me. We are God's priests. That's the point of the passage that we just read in 1 Peter chapter 2 that Ben read for us a few moments ago. That's the point that Peter's making. You also as living stones. He talks about Jesus Himself in verse 4 being the chief cornerstone. But you also, as living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. And then in verse 9, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. What I would say to our children and to the adults who are going to be sitting at the feet of Brother Brewer for the next several nights, as we contemplate examples of holiness in the Bible, what I would beg of us is that we make personal application of those things. Yes, obviously these characters are examples of holiness. What about me? How does that fit me? You know, would my coworkers say that person is a holy person? Would my neighbors say in the neighborhood that there is a holy man and a holy woman who live among us in this neighborhood? If they understood holiness. Again, I know that the word holy in English and modern usage means something else sometimes, kind of a piousness, you know, kind of a with the brown robes on and, you know, the folded hands and those kinds of things. Again, pious behavior would be characteristic of somebody who's a Christian, but piousness is not holiness. Holiness is distinctness. So do the kids you go to school with, do the young adults, the young people you go to school with, do they perceive that there's anything different about you at all? Do your neighbors guess as they interact with you that there's anything different about you? Do your co-workers know that there's something different about you? Would people see in us the holiness of God? If you are a Christian, you are one of God's holy priests. If you're not a Christian, then the invitation is to enter the priesthood, to become one of God's holy priests by dedicating your life to Him. And we do that in the beginning. We do that by confessing that we believe Jesus is God's Son and repenting of our sins and being baptized into Christ for the remission of sins. Take out your songbooks, if you would, and open them to number 283. We're going to sing this song as a song of encouragement to give you the opportunity to become a priest of God. Most of the adults, most of the accountable persons in this audience are already priests of God. And so the question for you as we sing this invitation song is, are you a living manifestation of the holiness of God? If we were living in the Mosaical period, would you be more likely to be in Nadab and Abihu's shoes? Although Nadab and Abihu weren't in their shoes at one point. Or would it be more likely that you would be characterized by, for example, the brother of Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar, with his zeal for serving God and manifesting the holiness of God? In other words, what kind of a priest are you? And if you're not the kind of priest who shows to the world the holiness of God, then do whatever you need to do between you and God, between you and some other person or people, or before the whole congregation, if that's what your need is. But do what you need to do. Ask God for forgiveness and recommit yourself right now to the work of the priesthood, the priesthood of Christ. And let's all dedicate ourselves to being God's holy priest. Can we help you to do that in some way if we can? Please come down to the front and show us, tell us how we can help you. Do that right now while we stand and sing. We invite you to come.